This was a matter of believing that God would deliver on the promise of descendants as numerous as the sand on the shore or the stars in the sky. In this commission of sin, Sarai and Avram are complicit.
The Bible is full of stories that we all know and love. But how well do we know them? The answer might surprise you. The Bible you thought you knew is going to dive deep into the exquisite details of the biblical stories that make them fascinating and transforming.
This week's podcast is in two parts and is based on Genesis 16 and 21, which features Sarai, Avram, her husband, and Hagar, Sarai's Egyptian maid. The three are involved in a messy triangle that caused considerable familial strife. Curiously, the two people who had been called by God look bad, whereas a poor, hapless Egyptian maid gets initially a really raw deal, but nevertheless ends up with a surprising future that she could never have imagined. Today's podcast will concentrate on Genesis chapter 16. Now, I did not make a mistake when I mentioned Sarai before Avram, because she clearly was the one driving the action in this chapter. This was not some feeble effort to deflect from the patriarchal culture which produced these texts. In this instance, Sarai was the main actor. In fact, Avram, the great patriarch, was rather passive. As for Hagar, she had no say whatsoever in the role she was forced to play. Let's take a closer look at this compelling story. Most Hebrew sentences begin with a verb, but not the first sentence of Genesis 16. Instead, we are told that Sarah, Avram's wife, had not borne for him. That's in verse 1. This statement, in which the verb is the fifth word in the sentence in the Hebrew structure, accents the importance of Sarai as protagonist in this narrative. Plus, when we do get to the verb, it is even starker than most translations indicate. A child or children are surely implied after the word she had not born, which is only one word in Hebrew. But by leaving out the word yelid or yuladim, that is child or children, the text underscores how dire Sarai's situation was, something she will soon confirm. Remember that previously God had promised that Avram's and Sarai's descendants would possess this land, meaning Canaan. That's in verse 7 of chapter 12. A little later, children were again promised when God reminded Avram that, quote, I will make your descendants as numerous as the dust of the earth, end of quote. That's in verses 15 and 16 of chapter 13 of Genesis. Still later, when Avram complained that he remained childless, God had him look up at the stars and said that that was how numerous his descendants would be. That's in verse 5 of chapter 15. Then, just before this incident, God gave a solemn oath that Avram's descendants would possess an extensive land. That's in verse 18 of chapter 15. Promises, sand, stars, solemn oaths are fine and dandy, but for now they mean little, since there are no children at all. That is the context for this story that emphasizes Sarai and the fact that she had not yet borne for her husband. One more thing. It should not be lost on us that both in terms of sentence structure and the story itself, Avram is smack dab in the middle of two women, his wife Sarai and her maid Hagar. This surely has implications for family dynamics. Because of her continuing infertility, Sarai decided to take matters into her own hands. According to her, God was responsible for her inability to conceive. That's in verse 2 of chapter 16. However, nowhere does a narrator place the blame on God. In Genesis 11, when Sarai was first introduced, we learn that she was barren. That's in verse 39. But that was a simple statement of fact. The reason for that condition is not specified. Nonetheless, here Sarai accused God. To get around a situation for which she believed God was responsible, she ordered Avram to sleep with her maid, whom Sarai did not bother to name. That's in verse 2. Indeed, neither Sarai nor Avram ever calls Hagar by name in the story. Sarai clearly wants to use Hagar as a sort of surrogate. Evidently, Sarai figures that because Hagar is her possession, any child she might bear would belong to her as the owner. She uses an odd expression to convey her wishes to her husband. She says to him, "Perhaps I will build up from her." That's in verse 2. The Hebrew word build or build up is bana, which is a pun on the Hebrew word for son, which is ben. That is why some translations ignore the pun and render as follows, "Perhaps I might have children from her." That is a passable translation, but loses the trenchant nature of the Hebrew at this point. Building is done with stone or wood, which are commodities that one purchases or gathers. Does Sarai's language suggest how she truly views Hagar? Merely as a commodity to be used as she saw fit? If so, this hardly flatters Sarai. Another matter that we need to factor into what is going on in this episode is another descriptor for Hagar. She was not just a maid, she was an Egyptian maid. Why is that detail significant? There are at least two reasons. One needs to be brought up now. The other I will mention in part 2. Only once since Avram and Sarai were introduced did they have anything to do with Egypt. That was when they fled to Egypt to escape a famine. When they were approaching the country, Avram persuaded Sarai to claim that she was his sister rather than his wife. That would save him, Avram reasoned, from being killed when the Pharaoh saw how beautiful his wife was and wanted to include her in his harem. Sarai agreed with this dubious strategy and predictably was whisked off into Pharaoh's house almost as soon as they arrived. In gratitude, the Egyptian king lavished Avram with gifts, among which were maidservants. The same word in plural as described Hagar in the singular. This cozy arrangement fell apart when the Lord afflicted the Pharaoh with plagues. In response, the Pharaoh criticized Avram for his blatant lie and ordered both him and Sarai to leave at once. That's in verses 10 through 20 of chapter 12. They did, but apparently kept the present. And that is how it happened that Sarai had acquired an Egyptian maid. Of course, that whole incident reflected a lack of faith on the part of Avram and possibly Sarai too. God had already revealed to Avram that the deity had a glorious future planned for him and his wife. That's in the very first verses in chapter 12. Avram should not have feared a premature death at Egyptian hands or for any other reason. If Sarai knew about this divine promise, she could have reminded her husband and talked him out of a plan that would likely backfire. The affair involving Hagar will disclose another example of faithlessness. This time, though, it was not Avram but Sarai who grew impatient with God's promise of progeny. So she came up with a dubious strategy of her own. She wanted Avram to have sex with the Egyptian maid, again in the belief that any child born from that union would legally belong to her because she owned Hagar. That's in verse 2 of chapter 16. To no one's surprise, Avram did not protest what his wife was asking him to do. When Avram and Sarai had lived in Canaan 10 years, which meant he was now 85, he slept with the Egyptian maid Hagar after Sarai had given her to him as a wife. That's in verse 3. Keep in mind, this was not a sin of sexual promiscuity or marital infidelity, but a sin of lack of faith in God's promise. Avram, and later Abraham, would have many other wives before all was said and done. Consult Genesis chapter 25. That was permissible in a culture where many wives were acceptable. This was not a matter of Avram's libido, though arguably that made it easier for him to do his wife's bidding on this occasion. This was a matter of believing that God would deliver on the promise of descendants as numerous as the sand on the shore or the stars in the sky. In this commission of sin, Sarai and Avram are complicit. Sinful or not, Sarai's scheme worked. Hagar got pregnant. That's in verse 4. As soon as that happened, however, Hagar looked askance at her mistress. Some translations render the phrase, "she looked on her mistress with contempt." That is a little stronger, but may be appropriate. In another verbal configuration, the term means to curse. The use of "in her eyes" after the verb, though, suggests that Hagar communicated her negative feelings with a facial expression of some kind. A handful of English idioms might work here, such as casting daggers, looking down on her, killing her with looks, and the like. In any case, whatever it was that Hagar communicated, it was not subtle. At least Hagar was gloating. At most, she was being contemptuous. Whatever it was, Sarai immediately got the point. Right away, Sarai complained to Avram, in effect blaming him for the way Hagar looked at her. That's in verse 5. Sarai blurts out, "The violence done to me be on you." Why did Sarai think this was Avram's fault? He had done what she had requested. Plus, why did Sarai construe the way Hagar looked at her as violence? Granted, Hagar was foolish to make an issue of her pregnancy while being fully aware that her mistress was so upset about her own barrenness, yet the poor woman had no choice in the matter. She was under Sarai's control, was not asked about her feelings about sleeping with Avram, and thus had no say about whether she was willing to go through with this arrangement. Hagar may have figured that she was justified in making some expression that let her owner know that she was not merely a walking womb at the mercy of anyone who wanted to take advantage. Avram did not rise to the bait when Sarai dumped on him. He retorted by reminding her that she was the maid's mistress and had complete control over her. That's in verse 6. Sarai took that to heart and treated Hagar so harshly that the maid was forced to flee. The verb used to describe Sarai's treatment of her Egyptian maid is the same verb that much later in the biblical story is used to describe Egypt's harsh treatment of the Israelites when they found themselves enslaved in that country. What goes around comes around. When Hagar fled, due to how Sarai mistreated her, the angel of the Lord found her by a spring in the wilderness on the way to Shur. That's in verse 7. The angel asked straight away where she had been and where she was going. That's in verse 8. The answer was as straightforward as the question. I am fleeing from Sarai, my mistress. Verse 9. Though she had not been called by name in the episode by either Sarai or Avram, she at least had the courtesy to refer to my mistress by name. If we were expecting comforting or sympathetic words from the angel, we will be disappointed. Without an ounce of empathy, the angel tells Hagar that she needs to return to your mistress. That relationship will remain intact. And subject yourself to her harsh treatment. That's in verse 9. Such advice may have made some sense if the angel had promised that Sarai had been contacted and agreed to ease up on her, but no such transaction had occurred. Without any indication that Sarai would have a change of heart, Hagar was told to return and submit. What is the benefit of being found by the Lord's angel when that angel does not lift a finger to make your life less miserable? Why does the Lord, who ultimately speaks through the angel, want Hagar to have to endure continuously shabby treatment? We are not told. However, we are informed that the angel has a future in mind for Hagar, something that she surely would have never imagined. Her descendants will one day be innumerable. That's verse 10. That is the same promise once issued to Avram and Sarai. Now, Hagar has a version of the same. The angel continues, a son will soon be born, and you are to name him Ishmael, which means God hears. That's in verse 11. Curiously, the angel elaborates on the name by pointing out that God has heard your affliction. If the Lord was reacting to Hagar's affliction at the hand of Sarai, then why was she ordered to go back and submit once again to it? That is not explained. It seems to be the case that the promise of innumerable descendants is to ameliorate the affliction that Hagar has suffered and will continue to suffer under Sarai. A strange aspect of this angelic prediction has to do with how Ishmael will live his life. He will be a wild ass of a man, the meaning of which is difficult to determine. Does this mean he will be a tough guy, or someone who has rough edges, or finds it difficult to get along with others, or has a violent streak? Certainly, conflict is intimated. Quote, his hand will be against every man and every man's hand against him. That's in verse 12. One way or another, Ishmael will have a contentious life. But there's more. His conflict will not be relegated only to strangers. He is going to have difficulty with his kin. Still, this is puzzling too. To which kin is the angel referring? Are these the kin who will derive from Ishmael's innumerable descendants? Or does the angel have in mind the kin he will have from Sarai's and Avram's descendants, who are also destined to be beyond counting? Or is the angel thinking of both groups? We can only guess. After this odd prediction that included multiple descendants as well as future conflict, the story brings Hagar back into focus. She had been told to name her son, but prior to his being born, she names the deity to whom she had been listening. She names God, not God's angel. That's in verse 13. Though her son was to be named because of God's hearing, Hagar named God on the basis of God's seeing. The Hebrew at this point is a tad obscure, but it seems to be something like this. Either, you are a God who sees me, or you are a God who sees. That's in verse 13. This naming is based on what Hagar thought, namely, have I also seen after God saw me? If this translation is accurate, Hagar is surprised at surviving after seeing God. It is one thing to hear God. That happens all the time. But in some places in Scripture, it is dangerous, even deadly, to see God. Well, Hagar figured that she had not only heard the angel of the Lord, but had seen God in God's own self. And in this instance, seeing God's angel was simply not to be distinguished from seeing God. Yet, she was still alive. That prompted her naming. It is important to keep in mind that this is the first person in the Bible who names God, despite the fact that she was an Egyptian maid owned by the matriarch Sarai. The first one in the Bible to name God is an outsider. The naming incident concludes with an editorial remark about the source of the well's name, Be'er La Ha'roi, or the well of the one who sees and still lives, verse 14. Just in case one wants to know where this well is, directions are provided. It's between Kadesh and Bereth. At the end of the episode, we learn that Hagar indeed had a son by Avram. The patriarch himself named the child. Apparently, Hagar had told Avram what had happened. After these 9 months, Avram had turned 86. That's in verses 15 and 16. Next week, we will see how Hagar fared when she went back to Sarai, her mistress.
I want to thank you so very much for listening to The Bible You Thought You Knew. I have a question for you. Do you have a question or topic that you'd like me to cover on the podcast? If so, all you need to do is head over to Apple Podcasts and do two simple things. One, leave a rating and review telling me what you think of the podcast. Two, in that review, ask anything you want related to the Bible. That's all you have to do. Then, listen in to hear your question answered on a future episode. Join us next time on The Bible You Thought You Knew, when we discuss Jesus' personal Bible. God bless.